while we're in there, folks. So I've had a few people say that they miss my more sort of the old fashioned, the old school rambling monologues that I used to do with a bit of B-roll up and whatnot. And what tended to happen was that I would kind of get a backlog of half finished videos or half finished blog posts that I, some of them had some things in common with each other and they kind of overlapped. And eventually I would end up with lots of kind of half out, thought out things. And I would like kind of lump them all together and then just kind of talk about it all and kind of, you know, cathartically kind of work it all through in one long ramble. And so I'm kind of in that situation again because we, you know, I've done a couple of posts on Substack about this, but we're kind of about to head through the eye of the needle. I mean, there's a lot of doom and gloom around at the moment, rightly so, because things, it really does look like things are going to get really difficult. And I feel like last year I spent a lot of, I did a lot of videos, I did a lot of content focusing what the actual problem was, because it was new to me, this kind of technocratic, you know, the digital surveillance thing, which we're all kind of familiar with now, that I'd never focused on it before. And it kind of left me horrified. And we look ahead now and we can see that it's absolutely coming. It's actually, like, say, 18 months later, and we're kind of closer to it coming to fruition than ever. It's just I didn't expect it would be quite as brutal. Now, whether that's by design or whatever, that's the kind of thing we'll get into here. But a strange set of circumstances has fallen, and I kind of touched on it in a recent article called Is This the Big One? Where I was kind of looking at it like the Titanic, because the economy's going to go down like the Titanic, and you've still got people dithering around and all of that. And I was, it's like when you see things popping up now, on the pubs going closed because they can't afford to pay the bills, and it's all heading in a certain direction. And there's this kind of assumption that, I think there's so much analysis of all of this, but we know what the problem is. You know, we can see it being ruled out. Like, so the time of like describing the problem is kind of like mute, because we're in it now, and things are going to get, whether we like it or not, things are going to get pretty bloody bad by the looks of it. And I saw a thing that went viral this week or last week, and it was a post on of a woman in Ireland whose coffee shop was about to be closed or something like that, because her bill had gone up to 10,000 euros, which is the same in dollars, I think. So she was going to have to pay 10,000 for a little tea shop or a coffee shop or whatever it was. And I thought, like, she's going to close. At the same time, we've got pubs in England that have been open for 300 years, and they are now closing their doors. They're shutting down because they can't afford to pay the energy costs. And the thing is, like, you know, there's been pubs and tea shops in England and Ireland, especially pubs, for hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, the idea that a pub which has been open and doing business since like 100 years before the Battle of Waterloo, before electricity or the modern energy supplies even existed, the pub was open and people were socialising and having drinks, even if it was just on a log-burning fire. And it seems to me that this kind of thing gets to the heart of the matter, because the system that we lived under, this kind of, the way I would frame this is that it's a complete failure of the system of globalization, of the neoliberalism of the last 40 years or so. So if they can't provide anymore, then their system is now deep. It's defunct. It's useless. If you can't do something as simple as like keep the lights on in a pub, if a pub can't actually function, it can't stay open, because of these issues with supply chains and the way that energy functions in the world that globalism and neoliberalism has created, then their system is useless and we need a new one. But the thing is, of course, they're already ahead of the game because their new system is the one which they're implementing. So it's as if it's as if we're going through this stage like a butterfly going into a chrysalis, like a caterpillar, which is now going to go into a time of pain and hardship and transformation inside the chrysalis. But then eventually it'll kind of emerge again, but it'll be a butterfly. Of course, it's not going to be a butterfly. It's going to be something absolutely horrific. And it's this kind of inevitability that I think has got a lot of people bringing them to despair. I was speaking to another content creator recently in private, and he was saying that he feels like a mouse trapped in a maze. That you take kind of all the exits are being blocked off, and there's no way out of this. And I'm just not that sure of it. And I think, well, okay, so things are looking pretty grim, but at the same time, there's this opportunity to say, well, to ask ourselves how we actually do want to live. So let's be honest, the system that we had, which it seems to be is now the one being phased out, the standard globalism of the end of history, as they say, where we would all just go on forever in this sort of globalized community of consumers and producers, where we formed our identities on what we bought, and where masses of people could just be moved around the world and especially into the West so that they themselves could be producers and consumers, along with the goods and the open borders and all of that kind of thing. And there's a great blogger on Substack called The Upheaval, who I enjoy reading, and he's got a new one out, and it was about China. Now, China's actually obsessed. This is the whole point of the article. China is obsessed with food security, and now that on the one hand it makes sense because China's a big country, but it doesn't actually have very much arable land. And another point, you've got to think of these geopolitical implications as well. So he addresses all of that. Another one is that because China imports like so much food, if tensions got too high with the Americans over Taiwan or whatever, the Chinese would be vulnerable to having their food supplies cut off. And so you've got all of these policies in China about food and food security. And the conclusion that he comes to is that actually these policies have been in China for longer than what you might think. And what he comes to is this idea that China is actually preparing itself to be completely in self-sufficient on its own food, and as much as possible, which they can do a lot because they've got this, the government will just do what it takes to make that happen. And so what he's getting at is that China is preparing itself for a world which is coming into being, which is post-globalization. It's a post-globalized world. So they are looking ahead at trends and macroeconomics and all of this. And they are now saying, well, all of this stuff, all of these supply chains, all of these things, this mass, the goods being transported all over the world, this mass consumption, that's coming to an end. And we're going to go back to something which is more in line with, on me video of the elephant and the whales, would be the elephants kind of striking back. And in the West, this has left us high and dry, of course. And what they seem to be doing, the Western elites class, in this what people are calling the Great Reset, which has become a kind of meme and a cliche in and of itself. Now, I mean, that may be so, but at the end of the day, it is happening before our eyes, and you can argue about why or how we got here, but we are where we are. And it's strange because the world that they're creating, of course, is also one where the supply chains are not going to be what they were. But they have got a different reasoning behind that, and it's to do with these sort of the climate agenda and all of this kind of thing. It's about having control over everything. So what I want to get at is that there's a problem here with people who oppose what they're trying to do, because there's this tendency that I've seen with people, and they are going to say, well, I want the old system back. I want my cheap holidays to Tenerife. I want my wine coming in from Chile or South Africa. And I want my beef coming in from Argentina and all of this kind of thing. The problem is you're not going to get it because you don't own that. We didn't own the system that was. Say the system that we've been living under for the last 40 years or so. Like that wasn't ours anyway. That was just the previous previous setup from the elite class, which is what they enjoyed, what they wanted to have at the time. And now they are like rejigging and kind of transforming their own system, like I say, like a caterpillar going into the chrysalis, and they think that the kind of the digital social credit thing that's going to be rolled out is their solution to this problem. This is going to be the next iteration with digital currencies and data gathering and everything. And so there's a problem with when people say, well, I'll eat as much steak as I want, or I demand that I get my cheap flights. So all of these luxuries, all of these goodies that have come in under the system of globalism and this kind of neoliberalism, this where everything was on the cheap and you could get as much stuff. That's done. Now, one way or another, that's done. It's because they just don't want it to happen. You know, it's their game. It's their system. And if they're going to abolish it, you can't kind of strong on them into making, like, bringing it back or whatever. So we are where we are. We don't just get to turn back. And I think to go back on the issue where you get this, like you get a pub that's been open for 300 years, and now you say, well, that pub, because that they don't want the, under the new system, the pub just won't come back. And I think this is interesting to think about, because you think, why is it that a pub could survive for 300 years and then suddenly just close its doors forever because of the breakdown of the energy? Like, why is there not a locally sourced form of energy? I mean, where I'm sitting now, I'm literally sitting on an ocean of coal, but we can't use that. Why? Well, we can't use that because of the climate agenda and the CO2. So do you see how they've slotted in these policies? This is kind of like what he was saying, where it's kind of like they've closed off all of the exits. They've all of the way that you can go. So what they're doing is where you'll have this crisis set before you, and there's only one off-ramp, and it will be the off-ramp towards the digital money and the eating the bugs and everything like that. So if you take, for example, another example of this would be the idea that you're going to carry on importing all of these beef, say, from South America. So that's a non-starter, because they're also phasing that out also because of the carbon emissions from cows and stuff. So everybody knows about this by now, but you get company like BlackRock and all of these billionaires, these corporations, they have invested billions in creating the synthetic meat. So the off-ramp which will be offered to us is this idea that you can't pay your bills, you can't keep the heating on. Here's some UBI, universal basic income, which will be digital, but there's going to be some strings attached, and there'll be some limits on what it is. Like, you'll be monitored on what you buy, so you will have to eat this or you will have to eat that. There will be an incentive structure, and what that is that you will then be consuming what these corporations want. It'll be like a subscription service, so you just get to consume what they put before you, because they've, through policies enacted elsewhere, closed off all other routes out. And of course, this leads a lot of people to despair, and a lot of people are unhappy about it. And I just think this the actual previous system that we had, I actually think that was very sort of insidious in just itself, because what that did was it gave somebody, what Macron recently said, the time of abundance is over. And he's right. But it's also true that for people, for nationalists or traditionalists, it was really difficult to wake people up to existential problems when they were so comfortable, when they had all of these goods and services and all of these products, when they had all of this nice cheese coming in from France and all of these different products that they could buy and form their lives around, you know, work and then get more products. And there was like an element of freedom to it, especially freedom of movement, moving around, which is all of this is now being phased out. All of this is now being just flushed away at breakneck speed, you know. And the Chinese are kind of ahead of the game. They can see what's ahead and they are like hunkering down. And I think there's not really any reason for us to suppose or take for granted that the only way out is their digital system. I mean, it's just to get back to what I was saying with the pub, like, how is it that we've had pubs which could open and operate in Britain for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years? So why can't we have that now? Is it, you know, why, you know, they were there before this technology, before these energy grids. And I don't see why they can't be there now. And it's as if we've been trained to think that there's no kind of escape from this kind of technological matrix, if you like. I mean, the pub could still be open. You may have to drink warm beer, and there may just be like a log fire, but like it's still like there. That's what the norm is. And so if we begin to think, well, okay, we've had enough of the doom and the gloom, and we can actually begin to look at local solutions, which is, you know, it's become a sort of a cliche, but I actually are starting to think that it is possible. Now, not everybody can go completely off grid, but I think the idea of that the fact that we've existed and sustained ourselves on our own land for like literally thousands of years without all of this, like we were doing all of this stuff before we had this globalized system, before we had the mass transportation, you know, before we had all of these like oranges coming in from Spain and all of this. Like we've actually done pretty well for ourselves. And I think it's a con when they're to present us with, well, the only off-ramp is to climb into the digital gulag. I'm not accepting those terms. I think we can do perfectly fine without it. Now, here's the thing. You will have to cut back. If I said this 20 years ago, if you said this as a nationalist, like, there's going to be some consequences for, let's just say, getting our country back, okay, for YouTube. And that is going to be where, well, you are going to be poorer, you're going to be under boycotts, because there would be boycotts placed on the country if let's just say if the BNP came to power, Britain would have been boycotted. And this scares people, this idea that if they faced material hardships, that it's not worth it. There's almost nothing worth it, because they can sit comfy at night, be watching the telly with like a bottle of wine from South Africa and kangaroo steaks from Australia, and, you know, like with like some goulash from Hungary, all of these wonderful things. Ooh, it's so diverse. The fact is, that is not the historic norm. The historic norm is that we made do on our own land, and not even that long ago. I remember as a boy going in Newcastle, where you had the Granger Market, and I would see pheasants and rabbits and like sort of pigs hanging up with sawdust on the floor. And then there'd be another counter where it was just fish sourced from our seas. And I just don't understand why that is not possible now. I don't understand why it's not possible to have a pub open or where we can't just have our own food. You know, where we are always have to be dependent on these kind of supply lines from globalism and corporatism, the giant corporations. You will own nothing and you will be happy is this thing you hear all of the time now. I don't think it's inevitable at all. I don't think that's even like it doesn't have to be likely. It mainly depends on the corruption of the politicians. And, you know, in World War One and World War Two, all countries had these things which they called victory gardens. I mean, this even in the sort of impending food shortages, it's like the government have taken no steps whatsoever to plant, say, carrots or potatoes on the commons land. Nothing. So what they want is where your only source of sustenance is giant corporations. Where if you go back to World War One, World War Two, they were turning football pitches into potato fields. There was cabbages being planted on roundabouts. Every little bit of land, and there's more than enough, even now with all the bloody housing, it can be done. You just sustain yourself by repurposing land to grow food. So you see straight away how corrupt the politicians are, because when your country is potentially facing food shortages, then the common sense thing to do is to begin enacting policies to stop that. But they haven't. They've done nothing of the sort. Why is it that there's all of these, why is it that you have football pitches left, right and centre which could be turned into potato fields, for example? We did it before. We did it before when we had a more common sense and sense of identity and all this. You know, we knew who we were. It also requires a high trust society. We've also got too many people in the country now because of the mass immigration, because of the system of globalization, which is another kind of ill that we've got. But the point here is that there's nothing to there's nothing to stop the government saying, let's have the council start planting crops. Even if they have to protect them. Why aren't they doing that? Nothing. They're not doing it because they are they're owned by the money power. The money power wants us to be enslaved by the corporations. I mean, a friend of mine, a neighbour, she just popped along the other day and dropped off a pot of blackberry jam, which she just picked out the back in the fields. Like, she's just gone wandering along. She's got loads of it. She's been making crumbles and everything. And it was then that the penny dropped for me on this particular issue, because all of a sudden I'm having blackberry jam on toast for my breakfast, which is, it's never seen a supermarket. It's never been anywhere near it. And I thought, and everywhere I looked since, I just see blackberries everywhere. And this is just the bloody blackberries. And straight away you think, it's ridiculous how dependent we've come on these corporations, where they're now going to have the audacity to treat us like slaves, when we've always just lived on our land. We've always had food in Britain. I mean, there's other places which are going to be harder hit, but I'm speaking as a Brit. Like, we've sustained ourselves on this country for thousands of years. There's no reason why we can't do it now, even if you include all the people which have been dumped on us from other parts of the world. So the point here is that I don't accept this paradigm where the only way you get out of the economic collapse and all of the problems which are coming now is to crawl inside of the digital surveillance grid. So this opens up questions about, well, where is the political leadership on this, for example? Why don't the government give us an option? Why? It's because they're all bought and sold, and this is the biggest problem. But at the local level, I see. I'm not actually in outright despair, but the problem that people are going to have to face up to is that there's no going back to the other system, and because it was theirs anyway. But at the same time, you don't have to crawl into the digital gulag either. There's another way. That's what you could think of as a third position, even, which is kind of like in line with what China's doing. Again, like people will complain because they've got their own sort of techno social credit system. Ours is being birthed now, but at least in terms of their food, the way they're sensible about the Chinese food security. Why aren't we doing that then? Because they want us always in this kind of enthrall to these parasites. And it amazes me because one of the clips that you see going around all of the time is that one by Yuval Harari. And they're looking ahead into the future. And he has this thing like, we don't know what we're going to do with all of these useless humans. And I think like that's based on an assumption that we will always just be a part of the kind of the grid, if you like, of the energy, the supply chains and consuming and producing, which is always that. And so if for example, they invent automation and AI and all of that, that's what he means. They're going to have all of this excess people over that they don't know what to do with anymore. But the problem is, like, it's not our purpose to serve their system. It's not, we weren't born to live lives in service to them. The arrogance of it is astounding. I'd turn it straight back around and say, no, you've got it the wrong way around. We don't have use for fucking you. Because at the end of the day, what do these people have to offer? If we can sustain ourselves on our own land, then what is it that these people are actually for? What is it they're actually doing except being psychotic parasites? And you can do it. We can literally do it. We live on an island. We've got sea. We've got all of these things. We've got the oceans on our doorstep. We've got arable land. To this idea that well that's it, folks. The supermarkets are closed. That means I'll just have to starve to death now, or like sign up for the government's new digital money. When I was working in Holland, in the petrochemical industry, the director used to have this kind of anecdote, this story that he'd roll out about the kind of mentality that he wanted his lads to have. And the gist of the story, I don't know, I've got no idea if this is true or not, and I never looked it up because I just like the story. But the story was that during the space race, you had the Americans and the Soviet Union going head-to-head to try and one-up each other, and you know. And there was a problem which both sides were faced with, and that was that how do you actually make notes in zero gravity? So the NASA came up with this idea where they created a pen, because the problem that you had was that when you wrote on a piece of paper, so goes the story. Look, I don't know if it's true or not, I just like it. The story goes that when the astronauts were using pens to write on a piece of paper, the zero gravity meant that the ink wasn't actually sticking to the paper and it was coming off and like floating around in the space shuttle. And so the Americans invented this a thicker form of ink in a kind of pen which was hooked up to like a robotic arm, and then it had this like pneumatic kind of pressurized system which was like sort of pushing the thick ink through out of the bottom of the pen and sort of imprinting it in the paper, in the notepad, and it cost them $500,000 to make or something like that. And the Russians took up a box of pencils. so the Russians like had this kind of, they thought about the problem, they were both faced with a problem. And the Russians had this kind of lateral thinking, which was just basic and common sense. And the Americans had this really expensive, complicated like system which they had to create. Again, I don't know if that's true or not. I just like the story because what it says is that sometimes, like, you know, you're faced with a problem, and there's one way that you can face it, which is a sort of the pencil, and common sense. Although the other one is like the really expensive, complicated system which relies on other systems and all of this. And so when you have a look at the some of the problems facing us today in the West, there's this tendency always to kind of fall back on complexity and to make things more complex. And it reaches the point of utter absurdity, and to the point where in the end, you can only kind of look at the solutions to some of these problems as just being a giant grift and a con. The idea that we can't grow our own food because it'll affect the climate or something is ridiculous. Even if you wanted to say, well, you can't have your beef coming over from Argentina anymore. All right, that's one thing because that was already their system. But then if you're going to say, well, you can't do any of this because of these policies, and then you also notice that the solutions which have been offered are the bugs and are synthetic meats. So on the one hand, they're creating the policies and funding the scientists to come up with all of this, all of these results. And then at the same time, they're also saying, well, this is now the solution. And we, out the other side of their mouth, out the other department of the same kind of corporate system, one department's busy drafting the policies and doing the science TM, and then the other side is actually coming up with the winners, coming up with the synthetic meats and the products that we're gonna have to be forced to pay for. Where you are, well, sorry, but the digital sort of currency is gonna check what your carbon footprint was for the week, and we're gonna determine what your consumer habits are based on this. This is a It's a horror and it's a dystopia, but it's also a bad, like a sort of ridiculously complicated answer to what their problem was, which is the kind of breakdown of neoliberalism and the globalist order of the last sort of 40 years or so, when, all we could do would be to incentivize growing, like having chickens and doing things at the local level. Very easy to do. As I said, we've done it before. And this it's just common sense. And I think the more people kind of alert themselves and get out of this thinking that we're kind of locked on these tracks and we're just heading like in this direction and there's nothing to be done about it. I think that's kind of the mindset of there's a sort of inevitability to it, which is really dangerous. And I don't think it has to be like that. At all. The truth is, we just don't need all of these people, all of these arrogant parasites, all of this corruption. And what all we're really talking about is going back to a historic norm, which isn't even that old, And what they're kind of putting forward here is just a freak show. It's just a complete abomination, and everybody knows it is, which is why they've had to rig the game in the first place. It's why they've had to create this giant scam. I mean, and at the end of the day, if we could do these things in World War II, why is nobody even asking this question? I mean, another thing that I forgot to mention, the blackberry jam. It's a sort of side point. The blackberry jam that the neighbor made, like it was full of seeds. You can't have everything, but it was so strong in just the taste of it. It really. Like I've never had a jam like it for a long, long time. It was just so like pronounced, the taste of it. And I remember last week I was eating a Granny Smith apple, and now when I was a boy, I remember when you ate a Granny Smith apple, it had such a strong kind of sour taste. It was a challenge to eat. You would like it, your eyes would be watering, and you'd be kind of your cheeks would go all funny because it was such a strong taste. And I was having one, I was eating a Granny Smith flat I bought from a supermarket last week, and I thought, it just dawned on us, like this doesn't taste like a Granny Smith apple. This is just like a generic apple. There's nothing the Granny Smithish about this at all. And I actually looked it up on the internet, and they were saying, well, yeah, basically all apples just taste the same now because of the processes that go into them, the processes that the chemicals that they use, and they don't allow them to sit on the you know, they get plucked too early because they then have to go into quotas and into the supply chain to get to certain places on time. And what you've got is this kind of steady erosion of just the most basic thing in the world, where everything gets turned into this homogenized mush. And it's almost like a precursor to some kind of synthetic veggie fake chicken, which is not which is just entirely processed, which has just had nothing to do with the natural world at all. So the natural world was being mutated, and then it becomes just something completely different, and which has got no connection to the natural world whatsoever. And these are the people, of course, who are doing this in the name of sustainability, in the name of, oh, we need to get back to the natural world. Well, let's do that then. But we don't need you to do it, because it's right there on our doorstep. So we'll just choose that option. You know, we don't need all of your lies and your bullshit and your manipulated science and your paying backhanders to governments and your fucking NGOs. It's all right on our doorstep, and it always was. And we can just go back to that. But, yeah, it may well be that we don't eat as much meat as we did in 2005 because there just won't be enough of it. Maybe that you find that you're eating more turnips than you used to. But, like, this is just the way that we always lived. Again, all it is going back to the norm. It's as if, instead of thinking it that we're heading into this kind of horror show, we can just think, well, okay, we will have to cut back. You'll probably see a lot more chicken on your meat, on your plate, than beef. Probably a bit more pork, I think. But, you know, it wasn't always like that. I remember I never ate steak until I was about 14 because it was too expensive back in the day. So this is just norm, the historic norm. And it's still a hell of a lot better than this digitized freak show that they are offering. So it isn't inevitable, you know. I'm often accused of being like a miserable twat, black-pilling and doom-mongering. And when I was making the content, mainly last year, when I was trying to get to grips with all this stuff, it was because I wanted to know how far the drop was. And now it's upon us. It's a case of thinking, all right, so we know what they're offering, but there's another way. And it is just more old-fashioned, more localized, less flamboyant, but in the end of the day, wholesome. And this, I think, is the beginning of the light at the end of the tunnel. But it's going to be a long tunnel, I'm afraid. So I'll catch you later, folks.